Michael Byers, welcome to Radio Canada International, and thank you for taking my call once again.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Now, you've just published a scholarly article that looks at some of the similarities between the Arctic and the space. So, what brings together these two cold, dark, and dangerous places?
Well, the title of the piece that you've just mentioned, Cold, Dark, and Dangerous, signifies one of the similarities. The Arctic and space are remote, extreme environments where human activity is dangerous and expensive, and these factors seem to push towards international cooperation. And that's actually what started my thinking that led to this article. I was looking at international cooperation in the Arctic after the Russian annexation of Crimea in 2014, and was finding that cooperation was continuing. And then I noticed that Russian rockets were being used to carry American and European and Canadian astronauts to the International Space Station, which suggested that cooperation in space was also continuing. And so I put those two factors together, the remoteness, the extreme conditions, along with this continued cooperation, as a research puzzle that I wanted to solve.
So what's the missing piece in this puzzle? What is driving this?
Well, there are a number of factors, and unlike some academics, I don't believe that one should try to simplify to one explanatory factor. And so in the context of this research article, I've identified eight different factors that seem to be contributing to ongoing Russian-Western cooperation in both the Arctic and in space. And to give you just a couple of examples, one of the commonalities between the Arctic and space is that both regions are militarized but not substantially weaponized. In other words, both the Arctic and space are used heavily by militaries for surveillance and for communication and sometimes for the transportation of weapons. But significant weapon systems are not actually based there. So in the Arctic, we have submarines that travel under the Arctic sea ice. We have bombers that fly over the Arctic Ocean, but those are not permanently stationed there. And in space, we have literally hundreds of military satellites providing communications and surveillance and even targeting for advanced militaries. But as far as we know, there are no anti-satellite weapons based in space, nor is space used for the deployment of weapon systems aimed at the surface of the planet. And I think that this commonality reflects, among other things, that weaponizing these regions would be extraordinarily expensive. It would be a major diversion away from the military investments and deployments that Russia and Western countries do elsewhere in the world. Russia, for instance, is very heavily extended in Syria and in Eastern Europe, in Crimea and along the other borders of the Ukraine. The Arctic would be an extreme stretch in terms of weaponization for Russia right now.
The other one of the other components that I found very interesting in your story is that you also look into kind of the international law that governs or relations between states in the Arctic and in the space. So what's the commonality there?
Well, the commonality is that countries that distrust each other, like Russia and NATO countries, have found forms of international law and international lawmaking that enable them to cooperate notwithstanding their distrust. So, for instance, they use a lot of what's called soft law in the Arctic and space. And soft law are non-binding instruments, so they're guidelines, they're recommendations. So there's no formal consequence in the event of a breach. But because they adopt these guidelines, because they make sense for all of the countries involved, they're usually followed. So they don't have the constrictions of binding law, but in actual practice, they work for all the countries involved. They work for Russia, they work for Canada, they work for the United States. Or to give you another example, in a lot of international lawmaking in the Arctic and space, they don't actually have votes to adopt legal documents. They adopt documents by consensus. Everyone has to agree. And that effectively gives a veto to every single country, which means that they're all on board all of the time when documents are adopted. Now, this might sound a little bit, you know, overly technical and uninteresting, but it's actually very important. They manage to create rules for the road, even though they don't trust each other. And that I found particularly interesting because, you know, my initial academic schooling was in international law, and I've become a professor of international politics. So this finding of practical solutions, making law work even in times of distrust, is very encouraging in terms of what it offers as a lesson for other fields of international relations.
So what are some of the lessons that you think we can draw from, you know, our experiences in the Arctic and in the space?
Well, I think the big one is that when countries have to cooperate, when there are strong reasons for cooperation, they find ways of doing so. And one of the key examples in this article concerns search and rescue. So search and rescue happens in the Arctic. We have a treaty on search and rescue that dates back to 2011. But what a lot of people don't know is that we have a much earlier agreement to share our satellites for the purposes of supporting search and rescue through emergency beacons that can be carried by prospectors, by sailors, by Inuit hunters going out on the land or the sea ice. And this agreement dates back to the Cold War, when the Soviet Union came together with the United States, Canada, and France to create what's called the COSPIS-SARSAT program. And so search and rescue has been a driving commonality in space and in the Arctic as a reason for international cooperation. And the reason I think it is so central is because ultimately we're all human beings, and search and rescue is needed when human lives are in danger. And when that happens, people forget about politics. They put rivalries to the side, and they work together to save those lives. I think that's a pretty important lesson as humanity faces some really significant challenges, for instance, like climate change. Or to give you another more extreme example, if we were to face a potentially devastating asteroid attack, countries would come together to deal with that. Faced with an existential threat, I think that what my research shows is that when the going gets really tough, when things are really dangerous, countries will cooperate.
Thank you very much. This is very, very interesting.
It's always a pleasure, and if anyone wants to find the article, it's available, freely accessible at the journal Polar Record, which is the journal of the Scott Polar Research Institute at the University of Cambridge.
And I'll make sure to put a link to it in my store as well.
Good. Thank you very much.